Come and go with me on my journey, on your journey, on our journey. I've been working on this sermon since I returned in July, and it's still not done. I was thinking yesterday, what's so hard about this? Why can't I write this down? A couple of things came to me. One is that mostly on our trip, people did not speak from scripts. They spoke from their heart. And the one person I remember speaking from a script, I can't actually remember the stories he shared. Speaking of stories, another reason why it's been difficult to write this down has been because it's a pretty heavy topic for me. We were on hallowed ground where blood had been shed. And to hear for 1 week straight about beatings and killings and terror and firebombings is hard. And that's just me hearing about it. That's not even me having to live it. And it's also a conversation in our sermon today. It's a conversation that for me, it's a conversation in myself because I'm still learning things. I'm still piecing things together. I'm still making connections. And you are part of that. Those connections are part of me. And so just to give you a little disclaimer, I'm not a historian. I actually have never been good at learning this date here and that date there, and Suzanne kindly brought her timeline that she made to get our context and our own, in our kind of some of the high, some major events that happened from, what do you have, 1955 on there to the... Brown versus the Board of Education, mm-hmm. That's where I started. Yeah. 54, yeah. But I do, even though I'm not a historian, I do love a good story, and I will share with you some of the feelings that came up through our trip. Freedom Summer, if you don't know, had three main kind of charges or goals. The first was to get voter registration in to promote voter registration among the Black population in Mississippi. They had been historically denied the vote, and not just denied the vote, but even registering was very difficult. There were literacy tests, such as copy down this part of the state constitution and then interpret it to my satisfaction. My being the white registrar. There were questions like how many bubbles in this bar of soap? And if you get the answer wrong, you don't get to register. And also your name will be printed in the newspaper for 2 weeks so that your employer knows for sure you're trying to get the right to vote. And then once you get to the polls, if you make it through all those hoops, then you'll have a poll tax. So if you're a sharecropper living hand to mouth, there's no money to pay the tax to make your voice heard in the polls. So when I think about the upcoming election, I can't imagine not voting. When we think about all the sacrifices that have been made in order to get that right. Which brings me to the first way that this idea of history as a line really doesn't work for me anymore. Because what happened with voting in Mississippi 50 years ago is happening now with voting here. And how do we make sure that people feel heard and have the right to vote if their vote is challenged or if their ID doesn't fit? The second part of Freedom Summer was the Freedom Schools, which Gordon mentioned in his reflection. And what a great idea. Grassroots learning, getting to learn about what you've never had in schools, getting to go to school when you haven't ever gotten to go before, learning to read when you haven't had that opportunity before, and learning French, if you want to learn French. And then the third kind of aspect of the Freedom Summer was the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, and Fannie Lou Hamer was instrumental in getting that. It was kind of like a parallel party. The White Democratic Party of Mississippi was not allowing any African Americans to be delegates. And so in 1964, at the Democratic National Convention, they took delegates that the Integrated Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party had actually gotten together. They had voted these people in to be the delegates. And they took them to Jersey City. Does that sound right, Suzanne? Atlantic City. And they tried to get to be the delegates. And she got to be nationally televised. And she was so important that the President of the United States interrupted her speech because she was talking about the beating she got after returning from a voting registration training in Tennessee. And she was questioning the America that we live in. And of course, the Freedom Summer, besides these three kind of intentional or focused branches, there was something that hung over Freedom Summer all summer long, and that was that on the very first day of Freedom Summer, three civil rights workers were murdered. They disappeared. They could not be found until August. So we spent a lot of time on our trip learning about James Chaney and Andrew Goodman and Mickey Schwerner and seeing the church that they went to go visit that had been firebombed before they arrived. They went to go visit and hearing from the families of those people who had been beaten up before the church had been firebombed. So I'm going to share with you some pictures. And I'm kind of talking about, I kind of frame this as how do we think about this, because there's no way I can tell you everything, every little day, what we did this day and what we did that day. I wanted to just kind of think about the architecture that we saw. And I thought, well, it's not really fair to talk about architecture without showing you pictures. So I have just a few pictures. And the first kind of architecture I want to talk about is homes. So we have the idea of our personal homes first. So this is a picture of a personal home. Medgar Evers, this was his home and in Jackson. And we got to go visit. And what was interesting about the architecture of this home was that he chose to have his home built in this subdivision. It was a newly, it was a developing area that was for African American families, and he chose a house that wasn't right on the corner. He wanted something a little further back, kind of between two houses, so he had a little bit of protection. And he didn't, because as the head of the NAACP for the state of Mississippi, he was in the hot seat, let's say. And in fact, when they built the home, they said, no, I don't want a front door. I want a side door. I want to have the side door come in through my carport, and that way I'll be safer getting into my house. And he said, you know what, I don't want big windows on the front part of my house. And so the windows are up pretty high. And he said, children, We're putting your beds on the floor. So when things come through the windows, you're not hurt. And his children knew that when things happen, quick, go to the bathroom. That's the center of the house, and that's the safest spot. And of course, his driveway is where he was shot in the back in June 1962. And then there was the architecture of a spiritual home. This is the, I'm sorry, I didn't get to show you. There's Medgar Evers. Here's the spiritual home. One of the great things for me about going on this trip was that it was Unitarian Universalist led. And so we went to three different UU congregations. This one here is the Unitarian Universalist Church of Jackson. It says different people, different beliefs, one faith. And it was like last night I came to the potluck here, and it was just like those potlucks were just the same. I was like, oh, I felt right at home. Like the really good food and really nice people. Oh, there's my hymnal. I even recognized things. I saw the principles. But what you'll notice about this architectural wonder is that it was designed to have no windows or glass on the front. I think they have like skylight maybe. But the front of this building is created so that it's very hard for a firebomb to get thrown into the front door or the front glass. And so even their spiritual homes were carefully created to, in the midst of this context of terror and violence. And then I wanted to talk about the architecture of the schools. So first we have a university, and we'll see. Suzanne, do you recognize this?
I do.
Do you want to tell us where it is?
University of Mississippi in Oxford.
University of Mississippi in Oxford. So on the left you'll see big old pillars. I call them pillars. I don't know what you call them. But they were so big, I was trying to think, how many people would it take to get our hands around those pillars? Maybe four, I was guessing. They were so big, and you can kind of see the scale. Suzanne is here in this picture kind of trying to take a picture. I did walk all the way across the street to get this picture because that school was so big. So the University of Mississippi is also called Ole Miss. What happened at Ole Miss? Anyone know? James Meredith was the African-American man who desegregated Mississippi higher education in 62. It was October of 62 when he was being guarded up the stairs so he could go in to register walking up these stairs. And they told us the story of how at night, when he was trying to study, he would be, of course, he had his own room. He couldn't have a roommate. You can hardly desegregate the university, let alone the rooms, right? So the on the floor above him, they would all night long bounce a basketball. And I said, well, couldn't have the house mother have done something to stop that? And our guest said, yeah, they could have. So I think of, oops, sorry, my picture went away. So this was obviously a predominantly white or historically white institution. Otherwise, you wouldn't have to desegregate it. And then let's compare that to our freedom schools that we have here. We have a picture of the whole group of us in front of us, freedom school that's getting renovated. And we also have a picture of a sign. So the Freedom School is getting renovated, and that is by the Dahmer family. I'm sorry, Pat, that I didn't tell you ahead of time. It's Dahmer, not Dahmer. But the Dahmer family, Vernon was a small businessman who was independently economically independent. And so he was a threat to the white power structure in Mississippi at the time. And so they said, okay, Target, you're it. And he got his voting card, I want to say, so January of 66. Okay, this is where the history thing comes in. So we had all these voting things happen in 64. In 65, after James Reeb was in Selma, and the Selma vote happened and people died in Selma, then came the Voting Rights Act of 65. And so finally in 66, Vernon Dahmer got his voting card in the mail, and it came after he had died from smoke inhalation because his house was firebombed. And he had been working with the NAACP for years to get his community registered to vote. So how did I get to Dahmer from this picture? Oh, because his family is renovating this school. And they were so lovely, weren't they? They were so warm and welcoming. And then next to it is a picture of the Freedom Schools, which is, there's a sign that talks about Freedom Schools, but then behind that sign is just a grass field. And the sign tells me the building was destroyed by a fire in 2007. And I said, well, huh. I said, how did that happen? And Roscoe or Jones, our tour guide at the time, he just kind of said, yeah, it's suspicious to me too. But so we have these huge pillars versus this memory of a school at a grass field.
Did the schools continue beyond that summer?
The Freedom Schools continue beyond that summer? I'm not sure. But that's a great question, because what it does is it brings us into the next questions. What do we want to know now that we know this? Because what happened to me is I went to Oxford, where Ole Miss is. That was our last stop. And I was at the potluck. They had blueberries, and they had a lot of seafood in Mississippi, if you can believe it. And they had really yummy food, and I was waiting in line, kind of salivating. I was trying to politely talk to someone who went to church there. And I said, well, we went, you know, to Greenwood today, and we've been in Hattiesburg, and we were in Jackson, and we saw, you know, the Meridian Philadelphia place where, you know, the three civil rights workers were murdered. And she was, like, looking at me and saying, you know more about Mississippi than I do. And I said to myself, oh, man, you know what I don't know about is Wisconsin. What's Wisconsin's story with this? And I came back, and I keep reading, and I'm learning about this, I'm learning about that. And then I come across this book, The Selma of the North, Civil Rights Insurgency in Milwaukee. What do you want to learn next? This story isn't done. The story is continuing because we are still here, and we are still asking those questions. And my table of books will show you brand new books that are being written by Joseph L. Wanger, by Mark Morrison Reed. Joseph came and spoke with us last year for our anniversary. Mark Morrison Reed is an African-American Unitarian Universalist minister, talking specifically about Selma and Unitarian Universalism. Knowing that in March, we have the opportunity to go to a 50-year not reunion, it's a conference. It's an opportunity to explore Selma the way we haven't had a chance to explore Selma before. Now, why Selma? Why is this important to me? Because we're sitting in James Reeb Unitarian Universalist Congregation. James Reeb is part of our story, and I don't know it. Or I certainly didn't know it 20 years ago when I started here. No, 19, 18. I'm still trying to figure it out. And so that's why I'm doing this. I invite you to join me. Come look at my pictures. Come look at my Suzanne's timeline. Come look, not pictures, books. Books, pictures. I hope that you share your journey with each other, with me, with yourselves. What was it about the civil rights movement? What was the first story that came to you? What was what do you remember learning about? What do you wish you had learned about? What do you want to know next? Certainly coming home from Mississippi to my friends in jail reminded me that new Jim Crow is alive and well. And so those connections continue to be made for me. And sometimes I think we're back where we started, and sometimes I know we're not. But I know that it's very complicated, these stories we tell each other, and that because we're all connected to each other, and we're connected to the Damers now, and we're connected to Roscoe Jones, and we're connected to Fannie Lou Hamer. So our community brings us the hope we need and the strength we need to do this journey, to be together in our questions and in our sadness and in our hopes. Because I do believe that the hope we get through interfaith dialogue and multi-generational singing and the work we did last night with Occupy Madison and the Tiny Village, all of that is part of the work we need to do to change our world. And certainly with the fifth Unitarian Universalist principle of the democratic process coming up on us on November 4th, it seems all really related to me.